In last week's episode, you heard the analysis of expert Dr. Sasha Reed when examining the murders of Joanne and Alex Katranak. Dr. Reed talked about what might have driven the perp to enact the savage crime in the way that they did, given the crime scene, and given the method of injuring and killing Joe and the baby. The violence of the crime, the overkill of it, suggested to Dr. Reed that for the perp, this was a deeply personal crime. It was someone known to Joe. It was someone who had a deep hatred of her. Someone who wasn't out to rob her or sexually assault her. Someone who wanted to physically hurt her before killing her, and who wanted Joe to be looking at them when they fired the single fatal shot. Dr. Reed's profile shares similarities with one created in 1995 by an FBI profiler named Steve Etter. Etter's profile was created at the suggestion of one of the other agents who had been working on the case since the disappearance, Special Agent David Rowe. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy of the profile report, but what we do have are notes of an interview taken in 2022 of now-retired Agent David Rowe. According to those notes, the FBI profiler said the following of the unsub, or unknown subject. The unsub was someone familiar with both the Katranak residence and the patch of woods where the victims were found, and had probably already been interviewed by the police. Retired Agent Rowe didn't recall what else the profiler said, but he did remember this, that until this profile was created, Patricia Rohrer was not even a person of interest, which makes that missing report even more important. Nonetheless, according to Rowe, Pennsylvania trooper Joseph Kochevar had taken Andy out to where his wife and son were found to jog his memory with any information that could be helpful, but Andy didn't have anything to offer. On the day after the visit, though, Andy suddenly remembered something that turned the entire tide of the investigation. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Robert Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. The discovery of Joanne and Alex's remains naturally caused a new wave of attention to the case, as well as a new wave of reports to the authorities. Local citizens called in the suspicious behavior of strangers, tipped off the police about unsavory characters they personally knew, and reported all kinds of possibly relevant information to help solve the heinous murders of this mother and child. One of those reports came from two locals who lived in the next town over, just miles away. A few days after the bodies were found, the police spoke to Edmund James Hartman and Michelle Jo Hewitt. It's not clear from the report what the relationship was between these two, but it seems in the brief write-up that they were together when they saw what they saw. According to both Hartman and Hewitt, around the time of Joe and Alex's disappearance, they both saw a small, dark-colored car that was parked on a gravel portion of the road that ran by the woods where the bodies were discovered. The car was there for a number of days and looked to be in fair condition. Hartman thought the car was a 1983 or 1984 Ford Escort or Mercury Lynx, and although neither was positive about exactly when they saw the car, Hartman was certain that it was after deer hunting season. During hunting season, it wouldn't have been so strange to see cars pulled over in the area, but at the time they saw the car, it didn't make sense to him. Newspaper archives show that hunting season in Lehigh Valley in 1994 had four staggered stages. Archery season began in early October and ran through mid-November. Then firearms buck season picked up on November 28th and ended on December 10th. Statewide antlerless doe season was short, just 3 days, from December 12th to the 14th, the day before Joe and Alex disappeared. Finally, though, there was an extended season from December 22nd to January 22nd, 1995, under something called the Southeast Special Regs. But this extended season seems to apply only to special regulation areas, which does not include Lehigh Valley. The point being, this car was almost certainly not spotted before December 15th, the day of its appearance, and there should be a way to find out more precisely, because these two witnesses weren't the only ones who saw the car. Paul Kovalchik, the farmer who found the bodies, confirmed to the police that he also saw the same car. He had actually gone up to the car to take a closer look and saw that the car radio had been ripped out of the dashboard and the car also had no tags on it. Kovalchik called the Pennsylvania State Police, trooper came out to take a look, tagged the car, and then left. Not long after, the car was gone, but Kovalchik didn't think the police towed it, meaning he thought whoever had left it there had come back to retrieve it. The vehicle, seen abandoned in the area where the bodies were found, around the time of the victim's disappearance, could be completely irrelevant and have nothing to do with the murders. On the other hand, it could be hugely important, because at that time, Andy's father owned a car that matched the description of the abandoned vehicle, and the police should have known that. Months before these three witnesses reported the abandoned car, a neighbor of Andy, Joe Katranak, told the police that Andy often left a dark-colored Sundance parked in front of their house, as opposed to in their rear gravel lot, and once that car had gotten ticketed. The neighbor noted down the license plate, and a trace of the plate shows that it belonged to Andy Sr. Could the abandoned car have been Andy Sr.'s? If you compare the Sundance to a Ford Escort or a Mercury Lynx from that era, they look remarkably similar. A simple comparison of the VIN numbers of the abandoned car against Andy Sr.'s car VIN could have ended the matter. But the officers investigating the murders never connected the dots and never tracked down the report that Farmer Kovalchik had made months earlier.
In any given case, investigative oversights aren't uncommon. It is hard to nail down every single detail, though an abandoned car by a crime scene around the relevant time frame seems much bigger than a detail. It's hard to know if it was in fact just an oversight or a deliberate strategy, i.e. ignoring bad evidence when you already have a suspect in mind kind of strategy. I say this because a report of the abandoned car came around the same time as when Andy offered the police information that made Patricia Rohrer suspect number one, and I promise we are getting there. I also wonder if by this point they deliberately were ignoring information that led away from Patricia because of another witness report involving a dark-colored car that was not just ignored, it was summarily dismissed and misdocumented. Mr. Walter Trotman was a World War II veteran, a National Guard sergeant, and a longtime security professional who happened to be out and about for work in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the early afternoon of December 15, 1994. Around 1 p.m., Trotman saw what he described as a gold car with black flanges around the windows. A woman with black hair that ran down to her shoulders in a black jacket was sitting inside the car as a man banged on the car door from the outside. Trotman described the man as tall, with straggly dark hair with blonde streaks that hung to his shoulders. Trotman was in his own car and had pulled over when he saw what was happening. Trotman's windows were open, and he sat about 10 feet from the incident as it unfolded. The car that the woman was sitting in was blocked by a gray car in front of it, almost right up against her bumper, so she couldn't drive ahead. The woman sat staring straight ahead, unflinching, as the man continued to scream and then climbed onto the hood and banged on the windshield. According to Trotman, the man was yelling, "Open this door! Open the door! What do you mean it's not my kid?" The man then got off the hood and into the gray car that had been blocking the other car, and he drove off. The woman drove off too, and Trotman noted the last number on her license plate was a 6. Alarmed by what he had just witnessed, Trotman immediately called the Allentown Police Department and reported that he saw a man screaming and threatening a woman on the road. The response to him from the police was, quote, "That's not our territory," and they directed him to call the Pennsylvania State Police. Trotman then called the state police and reported the incident over the phone, and that was the end of it, at least for that day.
couple of days later, when Joanne Katrinak's picture appeared in the paper, Trautman said he told his girlfriend, "That's her. That's the girl from the car." For some reason, though, he didn't call the police to tell them that he believed the woman being threatened in her car was the same missing woman they were looking for. Months later, after the bodies of Joe and Alex were found, Trautman picked up the newspaper and saw a photograph from the funeral held for mother and son. Andy Katrinak was in the photograph, and Trautman said he immediately recognized him as the man who had been banging on the woman's car on December 15th. Trautman isn't sure of the date, but shortly after seeing this photograph, he went to the police station and met with Pennsylvania State Trooper Robert Egan. He identified himself and gave Trooper Egan his statement, telling him exactly what he had observed on December 15th, 1994. According to Trautman, Egan was taking notes and may have been recording the interaction. "He was snappy," said Trautman, "and didn't seem very interested in what he was being told." A few weeks later, Trautman returned to the police station to talk to Trooper Egan again and see if the police had done anything with the information he had provided to them. Trautman saw articles every day in the papers about the murders, but didn't see anything reported about progress in the case. Trautman then returned a third time to the police barracks, and this time was told that Trooper Egan wasn't available. So he found a sergeant on duty and wrote a statement by hand and turned it over to him. The months ticked by, and Trautman continued to follow newspaper reports about the case. Frustrated that no one had yet been arrested, Trautman returned to the police on October 31st, 1995. We know that exact date because it's the first time a written report about Trautman even exists in the files. The report was written by Trooper Egan himself and states that around 10 a.m., he was summoned to the lobby to speak to someone about the Katrinak murders. And when he arrived, he recognized Walter Trautman. What happened next depends upon who you believe.
According to Trooper Egan, Trautman had visited the barracks to talk about this case 15 times previously, having initially met with Trooper Joseph Vasquez and then later with himself. Egan's report states that the first time Trautman showed up, he told Vasquez he had seen a Hispanic male arguing with a woman sitting inside a bronze Chevy Citation, a woman who looked like Joe Katrinak. The next time he came, again, according to Egan's report, Trautman said that the man he saw pounding on the car was Andy Katrinak, but that he had been wearing a wig. Egan says that every time Trautman came to the station, his description of the events and the people involved changed. Once, said Egan, Trautman wrote a letter that included a hand-drawn picture of the man and the woman that he had seen fighting. Egan's report states, quote, "The letter has since been destroyed because it was of no investigative value." Egan also states that Trautman was advised that his information was followed up and the argument he witnessed had nothing to do with the present case, that Trautman was thanked for his help, but that his repeated visits to the police had become harassing and disruptive in nature. Finally, Egan ended the report with a sentence, quote, "The action taken by this officer of removing Trautman from the barracks was, in this officer's opinion, necessary and warranted." Now, you might think I mistakenly said Trautman instead of Trautman, except I didn't. Egan's report refers to Walter Trautman as Trautman 20 times, and not once does it get his name right. Hold on to that information because we will get back to why it's important. Now, Trautman's account of the events that ended in his removal from the police barracks is completely different than that of Trooper Egan's. According to Trautman, he never even got a chance to say a word. Egan came flying out of the door and into the room where Trautman was waiting, banging it open in a fit of rage. Under oath, Walter Trautman said that Egan physically spun him around and slammed his hand into his back, making Trautman's head snap back. Egan then shoved him out the door and told him that if Trautman ever came back to talk about this case, Egan would lock him up. Trautman said he nearly fell down the steps and out of the building where his girlfriend was waiting. From there, he went straight to the hospital because of the pain in his neck and back. 2 weeks later, Trautman's attorney wrote to the captain of the barracks, informing him of the incident and of his client's injury, but clarifying that Trautman had no intention of suing the police. Trautman, even now, just wanted a chance to present information about what he had witnessed on December 15th to the right authority, one that would take action. and also requested that Trooper Egan face disciplinary consequences for manhandling and injuring him. 4 months later, in March of 1996, Trotman's attorney finally received an answer from the police. An internal affairs investigation had cleared Trooper Egan of the misconduct that Trotman had accused him of. It concluded that Trotman had been harassing and argumentative, that he had yelled and screamed at Egan for not taking action on his information, and that he was escorted without any force out of the building. No disciplinary action would be taken against Trooper Egan, and the matter was now closed.
It's important to know that whatever took place between Trotman and Egan is purely he said, he said. There were no witnesses to the event, so we don't know for sure whether Trotman was assaulted by Egan or not. What we do know, by Trooper Egan's own admission, is that Trotman visited the barracks multiple times to give information about what he witnessed on the day that Joe disappeared. Over a dozen visits according to Egan, but around four times according to Trotman. We know, again by Egan's own admission, that Trotman had written a letter and drawn images of the man and woman he saw, and that Egan destroyed the letter. Finally, what we know according to Trooper Egan is that he investigated the information that Trotman provided and found it was not relevant to the Katronach case. The problem with all these admissions, though, is even bigger than the issue of whether Egan assaulted Trotman. And that's this. If everything Trooper Egan admits is true, then this also means that Trooper Egan either destroyed all the evidence related to this lead or failed to document it. If Trotman had visited the barracks 15 times to report the incident that he witnessed, why wasn't there a single police report documenting those visits? The only report is the one made in the day of the altercation between Trooper Egan and Trotman. If Trooper Egan investigated the incident that Trotman reported and found it was irrelevant to Joe and Alex's murders, where are those police reports to show that investigation? And why would Trooper Egan proactively destroy the letter and drawings that Trotman submitted rather than just putting a copy in the file, along with the dozens of other irrelevant reports that citizens made about the case? It's important, of course, to determine whether or not Walter Trotman, in fact, saw Joanne and Andy fighting the afternoon she disappeared, because that would help determine what exactly happened to Joe. But it's just as important to determine why Trooper Egan deliberately destroyed and buried the information that Trotman was desperately trying to convey, because that could help determine why the case became all about Patricia Katronach.
The answer to why Trooper Egan was completely disinterested in Walter Trotman's information might lie in the FBI suspect profile we mentioned at the top of the episode and what happened in the days after Joe and Alex's remains were found. Remember, again, initially the police's prime suspect was Andy Katronach, despite Andy trying repeatedly to convince authorities to look into others, specifically his ex-girlfriend Patricia Rohr. Media reports from the time are interesting. While Andy does bring up Patricia repeatedly to authorities, he never once mentions her to reporters. Rather, in the near daily reports of the investigation, Andy keeps saying the same thing. He thinks that someone who was romantically obsessed with his wife might have stalked and taken her. In one strange report, he says he even thinks he knows who it is and that the man is someone handsome. This might have been his way of suggesting the culprit was Michael Jack, Joanne's ex, but it's unclear if he realized that the police had already cleared Jack. Investigators have been locked in on Andy from the start, but kept coming up against the same issue, Andy's alibi. Which might be why Special Agent David Rowe testified that he had interviewed Andy a number of times, but the interviews, quote, did not concern his possible involvement. In fact, by the time Agent Rowe interviewed Andy on January 14, 1995, a month after the disappearances, he testified that the issue of Andy's involvement had been, quote, long since left behind. At the same time, though, he said, Patricia Rohr was still not a focus of the investigation. They had no singular focus at the time, according to Roe. They were just trying to gather as much information as possible. It was in the course of that information gathering that their sights finally settled on Patricia Rohr. On April 13, 1995, 4 days after the discovery of the bodies, Pennsylvania trooper Joseph Kochevar took Andy for a drive out to the crime scene and asked if he knew anybody familiar with the area. Andy could think of no one. A very odd statement indeed, because an old girlfriend of Andy's, Terry Benchini, lived just 4 miles from where the bodies were found. If that name sounds familiar, it's because it has come up once in the season already. Terry Benchini is the woman who was at the Katranack house a few days after Joe and Alex disappeared. The one who said she had taken pictures of Joe and Alex and a piece of Joe's jewelry to a psychic. You might recall, the psychic then reported back that she saw that Joe and Alex were taken by two men across state lines and were being held somewhere. Terry Benchini was able to get the pictures and jewelry from the Katranack house to give to the psychic because she was that close to the family. So close that, according to Andy's mother, Terry and Joanne would go shopping together every so often. So close that in 1999, 5 years after Joe and Alex disappeared, Terry and Andy eventually got married. The point being, when Andy told Trooper Joseph Kochevar that he didn't know anybody who was connected to the area that the bodies were found in, he was either completely forgetting about his on and off girlfriend, or he was lying.
The next day, Kochevar interviewed Andy at length, this time with a focus on Patty. He asked for photos of her, but Andy said he had none, since he'd gotten rid of them when he married Joe. Andy reiterated that on December 12, 1994, 3 days before Joe and Alex were abducted, Patty had called their home, and his wife had yelled and hung up on her. Kochevar asked Andy what Patty did for a living, and Andy told him she had trained horses and managed a stable. When asked for the name of the stable, Andy couldn't recall it, but he remembered how to get there. He gave Trooper Kochevar directions, and the officer realized that the stables were in the very direction where the bodies were found. When he later checked, it turned out the stable was exactly 2.1 miles away from the crime scene. Kochevar asked Andy if Patty owned any guns, and Andy said yes, she had rifles, but didn't think she had any handguns. Andy ended the interview by telling the officer he was concerned because Patty was a vengeful person. By this point, the FBI profiler mentioned at the top of this episode had created a profile of the unsub and handed it over to the investigators. Again, we don't have the actual profile created, so we don't know whether he believed a man or woman had committed the crime. But, according to FBI Special Agent David Rowe, the fact that Patricia Rohr was familiar with the area where the bodies were found coincided with another case that Trooper Kochevar worked. In that case, from many years earlier, the female victim had been bludgeoned to death by another female. This is the point, according to FBI agent David Rowe, that Patty became a person of interest. A few days after Trooper Kochevar was given this information, a different Pennsylvania state trooper reached out to Officer Robert Poplin of the Anson County Sheriff's Office in Wadesboro, North Carolina, the jurisdiction where Patty Rohr lived. Poplin had been the arresting officer in a theft case involving Patty. According to Poplin, Patty's one-time boyfriend, a man by the name of Walter Blaylock, had sought Patty's help selling some horses. Patty hadn't realized at the time that Blaylock had stolen the horses and they didn't actually own them. Patty and Blaylock were originally both charged, but the charges were then dropped against her. Nonetheless, Officer Poplin sent a copy of Patty and Blaylock's arrest report, along with copies of their full criminal histories, to the Pennsylvania State Police as requested. Around this same time, Trooper Joe Kochevar made a visit to another of Patty Rohr's ex-boyfriends, Conrad Hewitt, who happened to live in Slatington, Pennsylvania, the same little town where Joe and Alex's bodies were found.
Hewitt told the police that he'd met Patty in the summer of 1990 at a local bar. At that time, he said, she was living in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with a man by the name of Andy Katranak. Hewitt asked her out, and she accepted the date. They dated for about 6 months before she moved out of the house she shared with Andy and moved in with Hewitt. During the time they were together, Hewitt recounted that Patty boarded horses in a stable on Best Station Road in Slatington, Pennsylvania. Best Station Road was one of the roads that intersected at the corner of the woods where the bodies were found and was likely the same stable that Andy referred to when he was telling Trooper Kochevar about it. According to Hewitt, Patty would go out to the stables twice a day to feed and ride her horses, sometimes riding them from the stable to his home a couple of miles away in Slatedale. Hewitt himself wasn't interested in horses, but he recalled that he once went to the stable and he saw Patty whipping one of the horses unmercifully. He tried to stop her, he said, but she got angry and turned on him, so he backed off. Hewitt told the police that he saw a similar mean, violent streak in Patty as they lived together. Once, he said, she had gotten into a fight with another woman and pulled a knife on her. The woman's boyfriend stepped into the fight and ended up getting slashed in the hand by Patty. Her temper also turned her violent against him, said Hewitt. Often, when they would argue, she would physically attack him by punching, kicking, and slapping him. Once, it got so bad that they both ended up physically beating each other. That was the time that Patty left and took shelter in Andy Katranak's house, and a few days later, her and Andy both came back to get her things and to have Hewitt arrested. Yes, this was that ex of Patty's who had beaten her black and blue that the police were now questioning for information about Patty, since she was now not just a person of interest, but she was the only person of interest. Their focus on Patty must have only intensified when Hewitt told them that when Patty lived with him, they had done target practice together, and in his opinion, she could handle a gun well. She knew how to handle his .22 caliber rifle and could hit a target. As far as he knew, she did not own a handgun, but her mother did. In fact, Patty's mother, Mrs. Chambers, had once come to the house when he and Patty were having a fight, and she brought a .38 caliber revolver with her. Mrs. Chambers took the gun out of her bag and placed it next to her as she confronted Hewitt, as if to intimidate him. Finally, Hewitt told the police the last time he had any contact with Patty was back in December of 1994, when she reached out to ask if she could borrow $500 from him to go to some horse show. He had declined, and they hadn't spoken since.
The authorities were slowly but surely circling Patty Rohrer. They interviewed the owners of the stables, Susan and Brian Kern, where Patty had kept the horses in Slatington, Pennsylvania. The Kerns had told authorities that Patty was moody, didn't pay what she owed toward the horses she had purchased, had failed to pay her stable rental, and ended up moving to a different stable. They were worried about one of the horses they had sold to her, so they went to check on him at the other stable. There they found the horse looking malnourished and abused. They tried to take the horse with them, but the stable owner threatened them with a gun, so they backed off and took a legal route instead. After getting the horse back, Patty's mother reached out and paid off what Patty owed, so they relinquished the horse to her. Patty hauled the horse back to North Carolina, where she had moved to, and the Kerns later found out the horse had died in her care. Finally, the Kerns told the Pennsylvania state officer that they had learned that Patty had other horses in other stables, and she owed money to them too, as well as the local veterinarian and an animal supplier. Down in North Carolina, where Patty lived, the FBI had also homed in. On April 24, 1995, FBI Special Agent Dwight Ayers visited a man by the name of Leroy Rouse. This visit presumably came about because back on December 22, 1994, when Patty was first interviewed, she told the police that on December 15th, the day that Joe and Alex disappeared, she had bought grain from a black man named Leroy at the Welcome Milling Company, as she did every Thursday. When S.A. Ayers visited Rouse months later, Rouse confirmed what Patty said. Rouse, who'd been employed at the Welcome Milling Company for the past 14 years, told Ehrich that Patty had been buying grain from them for the previous 3 years. And according to Rouse, Patty usually came in to purchase grain for her horses on Thursdays, just as Patty had said, but also that she sometimes came in on Saturdays. Even though many months had gone by, Rouse remembered that Patty had bought grain from him sometime before Christmas because he recalled them talking about the upcoming holiday. A few days after gathering this information, Special Agent Ayers gave Patty Aurora a visit. From the records we have, it seems there had been some communication between investigators and Patty since the last documented contact back around the time the victims disappeared, because the report from this May 1995 visit reads, quote, "Rohr further advised she is still undecided as to whether to submit to a polygraph examination in order to remove her as a suspect in the kidnapping of Mrs. Andrew Katranak. She stated she has subsequently retained an attorney to represent her concerning this matter." It's unclear when Patty had been asked to take a polygraph, as this report suggests, and when she had declined, because there's simply no record of it. To the contrary, in the December 22, 1994 interview, Patty explicitly said she was willing to cooperate in all ways, including by taking a polygraph. Nonetheless, the report from this latest visit also states that Patty said she'd been trying to nail down what she'd been doing in the days leading up to and after Joe and Alex had been kidnapped, identifying people she thought could possibly be alibis for her. She remembered having bought kerosene on December 14, 1995, the day before the kidnappings, from a female cashier at a gas station. This was information she had provided in her earliest interview as well. After that interview in December, Patty had returned to the gas station to speak to the same cashier to see if she recalled Patty being there on December 14th, specifically, Patty having some trouble with the pump at the time. After this latest interview with Patty, and presumably after speaking to her, Special Agent Ayers made a trip to the Tyro service station where Patty said she had bought the kerosene. He spoke to Elizabeth Hill, who worked as a cashier at the station. Hill confirmed that back in December, the kerosene pump at the station was indeed acting up. She also confirmed that at some point back in the time frame, a woman had come in and asked her if she remembered her from before and remembered she had trouble with the pump. Hill didn't know why this woman was asking these questions, but she did recall the incident taking place. Finally, S.A. Ayers visited the Lakeview Oil Company, a.k.a. the Carol Haynes gas station. Back in her initial statement in December, Patty had told the police that on December 14th, the day before the victims disappeared, she had visited the gas station because she had lost a key and thought she had left it there. Ayers spoke to an employee at the gas station who was familiar with Patty. She was a frequent customer, and the employee recalled a time months earlier when Patty had come into the station to ask if she had left her keys there. The employee had no idea when this took place, but recalled it was in the afternoon after the lunch hour at 1 p.m.
If the authorities were flummoxed by Andy Katranak's alibis, they now had to contend with multiple alibis that their new prime suspect, Patricia Rohr, had provided. They were able to somewhat verify the information she had given them about the day before and the day of the disappearance, which made the case against her complicated, but not impossible. An FBI memo dated June 16, 1995, stated that Patricia Rohr was a suspect and then laid out the case against her. Patricia Rohr is former girlfriend of Andy Katranak, husband and father of victims, during approximate period 1983 to 1990. The following has been developed. She has lived in the past at the residence from which victims disappeared. She ran a stable 1 mile distant from location where victims found. However, she denied to a relative that she knew where Heidelberg Township, Lehigh County, was located. She has a propensity toward violence, and 2 historical knife attacks have been verified, along with several physical assaults. She advised PSP investigators that she has not been in Pennsylvania since 1991. However, she has positively been placed in eastern Pennsylvania along with a male companion during October 1994. She has declined requests by both PSP and FBI personnel to submit to polygraph examination relative to the kidnap and homicides. She called the Katranak residence several days prior to the disappearance, and there was an angry exchange with Joanne Katranak on the telephone. even more interesting than the substance of the memo was the subject line of it: murder for hire. Next time on Undisclosed. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more Undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Methil Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.